Brian Dawson of the Anti-Neocon Report, ANCReport.com, talking with military analyst Andrew Illingworth, also from ANC Report, about the recent events in Iraq, Trump pulling out of UNESCO, the Iran deal. I kind of want to breeze through these two things because the juicy story is the Kurds being pushed out of Iraq and Iraq regaining its oil fields and the political implications that that's going to have. How you doing, sir? Welcome back to the show. You ready to get into this?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
What do you want to start with? You want to go over Trump?
Let's cover the UNESCO.
UNESCO, sure. That was the most... Yeah, we'll do them in order. Okay.
And going by private conversations we've had before this interview, I have to conclude, just as you pretty much do, that everything Trump has done is at face value meant to appease Israel, but has no real effect. It has no lasting consequences. He's actually carried out something that's redundant, because it's a redundant action, because the US wasn't even financing UNESCO since about 6 years ago. So
right, it's been like typical Trump hot air. He's a lot of hot air and little action, and that's you know. But saving face is important to these people because you're dealing with a bunch of egomaniacs. So that's...
Yeah, no, that's pretty much right.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, and I know a lot of people hate on Trump kind of for the wrong reasons, call him every ism in the book and a Nazi and whatever. That,
yeah.
Identity politics aside, all he did was really nothing that the U.S. wasn't doing anyway. I mean, our level of ankle grabbing for Israel is pretty much the same as it was before. Barack Obama, and you know, pulling out of UNESCO is over the Israeli-Palestine issue. It's not like,
of course,
we're against funding World Heritage sites because of the price or something. That has nothing to do with it. They got out of UNESCO because UNESCO allowed Palestine full membership back in 2011.
The important thing to remember is that Obama was the one that started this.
Yeah, but if it had been a Republican, it would have been the same thing. Yeah, Obama did it, despite Netanyahu and him hating each other.
Obama, oh, yeah, still, of course.
Yeah, he was still gaffy.
Yeah, yeah.
it was Victoria Nuland who was trying to cite an old law saying, oh, well, we're not allowed to acknowledge that. It's so stupid. It's like the one China policy where we can't admit that Taiwan is Taiwan, even though they have their own government, their own tax system, make their own laws, have their own passports, their own money, their own everything, and they're their country. But no, you know, because of political pressure from China, and this can only happen in the realm of politics. Like, based on any other measuring stick, anybody would be like, yeah, that's Taiwan, that's China. That's Palestine, and that is Israel. And these are the annexed territories that Israel took. I mean, Palestine exists, and of course they can have membership. They have World Heritage Sites, they belong there. But for political reasons, and the Israeli lobby, and the U.S. is just so entrenched with Israel financially because of this aid recycling that goes on.
The lobby is very powerful.
It's the lobby, but the lobby is powerful because it lobbies itself money. We'll explain that in a second, but because I want people to understand that it happens on a federal and state level. But essentially, because Palestine was given full membership, they cut funding to UNESCO back in 2011 under President Obama and his whole administration, which was about 22% of the total funding. So the UN had to go around and find 22%, and the U.S. has just sort of been there in name, being a dindu. They do nothing. They're just there in title. And all Trump did was sort of bring more sunshine to it by saying, you know what, we're leaving. Which I guess means, well, there's no chance of us funding you later in the future over the same issue. But the timing was something. Like, why all of a sudden now? You need to throw Israel a bone. And then he decertified the Iran deal. Well, that's UNESCO. Do you have anything else to add to the UNESCO bit? I mean...
No, I pretty much...
Pretty much all, that's all it was.
Pretty much.
Continue doing what the U.S. was already doing, except now we officially are out. Which I think is
And
better.
That's all it is it's just face value. I mean, the practical U.S. involvement ended, like you said, back in 2011. The actual practical involvement ended in 2011. And that was, and ever since then, it's just been a ceremonial sort of face value involvement. And now Trump's just ended that myth.
It's hot air policy.
If anything, he's expelled a myth, if anything.
Yeah, he made it more clear because a lot of people didn't know that the U.S. pulled out in 2011 because the media didn't attack Obama the way they do Donald Trump. They hate Donald Trump. Obama, I mean, you have to realize he's got more blood on his hands than a woman playing with herself on her period. That guy invaded Libya. He tripled the size of the war in Afghanistan. He's the reason we're in Syria. He was funding Al-Qaeda. So was Hillary through the State Department. Funding Al-Qaeda in Syria, funding Chechens, bombed Yemen, bombed Pakistan, bombed Somalia, helped the French invade Mali. Like, he was a warmonger president. But it just all slid off him like Teflon. Like, he had three times
as many
wars as George Bush Jr.
But wait a second. Didn't he win a... Didn't he win a Nobel Peace Prize?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Okay. You know what else is? They had decided to give that to him, like, prior to him becoming president. And as soon as he did, they gave it to him. And the interesting thing is the pretext for that, you know, other than the liberals cucking and tripping over themselves, was that Obama was going to reduce nuclear proliferation, right? So this is what Obama did. All he did was he takes something like a bomber that has X number of warheads or submarine that has X number of warheads and say that counts as one because it's one plane or one sub. So instead of counting all the nuclear weapons, they just grouped them together and go, okay, this unit has this many nuclear weapons and that's going to count as one. So on paper, it reduced the number of nuclear weapons. But actually, he slightly increased it because he increased the number of subs and planes, the things that can carry these things and ICBMs and all that. But they were just saying, oh, no, that's one battery. So, yeah, it's just, it's semantics.
Yeah, he decreased,
like
he decreased the enduring stockpile. It's called the enduring stockpile, which is the stockpile, which it's not even in active service. It's just there in reserve. But the actual number of active warheads increased.
Right.
That is ready to be deployed within a certain amount of, I think, minutes. I think that's how it works now.
the Nobel Peace Prize is a joke anyway, ever since they gave one to Henry Kissinger. And several Israeli prime ministers have gotten – I mean, the Nobel laureate's a joke. They're like, oh, well, look at how many of Nobel Prizes this area is getting or this country's gotten. We're like, yeah, and look what these people did. I mean, it's all political. It's like a beauty pageant. It's identity politics and stuff. It's not based on any sort of merit or peace or – you know, no real anti-war person has gotten the Nobel Peace Prize for many decades. So,
Talking about prizes, and you recently hear about this, I think it was Nobel Prize related, these activists talking about how the world stockpile, how nuclear weapons need to be abolished. Why didn't they say that during the time of Obama?
You know, what's interesting is, there was a president that called for the destruction of all weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East back in 2003, and that was Bashar al-Assad. He agreed to get rid of his chemical weapons, which he did have, if everyone else in the Middle East would get rid of their weapons of mass destruction, which included nuclear weapons, which, of course, there's only one state in the Middle East with nuclear weapons.
That is correct.
And they had a fit about that. But he's a dictator, and Obama gets a peace prize.
Yep, that's the logic of the liberal-orientated world politics.
It's amazing. All of them, the Republicans too, they all were on the Assad must go train. Bernie Sanders was on it. Hillary was on it.
Hillary was the top proponent of it.
Libya was her backyard.
I'm shocked. I always, growing up, I always figured it was the Democrats that were against war. And, and it was the Republicans that were the warmongers, the war hawks, you know, revivals of the war hawk
party. That's quite typical. I pointed this out in the book I wrote called The Separation of Business and State. For younger people, I mean, like, you know, in their 20s now or so, early 30s even, the history sort of started in the year 2000 with George Bush and the invasion of Iraq because it was such a huge event, and he was a Republican. But historically, World War One, World War Two, Vietnam, and Korea all started by Democrats. Yeah. And, you know, then they call Bush a neocon. Is that, but, you know, his father and Reagan, they, you know, they invaded Grenada and Panama and they had some wars. There's nothing on the scale of in Korea or Vietnam or anything, but they had some smaller wars. In Iraq War, but when the Republicans did it, they were rightly ridiculed. And I think a lot of that was because the Iraq War came in tandem with the internet and social media. And so there was a way to
that
break
is
that
correct.
Media monopoly.
Yes.
Whereas Gulf War One, for example, back in 91, which is Bush's father, was a Democrat, although Clinton had bombed that would bomb them too. But Gulf War One was like uniformly supported, yellow ribbons everywhere. Like it wasn't this disaster. And of course, Gulf War One didn't go as far as the Second Gulf War because they understood.
No,
that
well,
it would
Gulf
be a quagmire.
War One was what? It was like a 6 month build up and then an air campaign that lasted about 6 weeks and then a ground invasion that lasted 100 hours and then it was over.
Yeah.
The actual fighting only lasted about 4 days or something.
Well, Iraq and then just sort of finished America's... a brutal long war with Iran that was sort of a stalemate. So anyway, I'm just saying propaganda-wise, the television did a much better job because they were uniform on the second Iraq War. Every single one of them was saying there's weapons of mass destruction. All of them were talking about you know, the yellow cake from Niger, the smoking gun, the mushroom cloud, all the lies. CNN did it. Fox did it. They all did it to one degree or another. No dissenting voices. But online, people were debunking these things in real time and saying if they had any evidence of WMDs, where is it? The weapons inspectors like Scott Ritter and so on were saying they don't have these things. And they could go online and say this and get somewhat of an audience. But nowadays, it's much bigger. And because of the Iraq War, it's hard to go back. And that's one of the great bigger reasons why the U.S. can't help the Kurds. There's no way the U.S. public is going to stomach reinvading Iraq, especially under Donald Trump.
Exactly. We'll get to Iraq soon enough, I'm sure. But just to clarify, because there are some liberals out there on social media who are in the media and politics who have this fantasy now that the U.S. should go into Iraq and dissolve the Iraqi army. First of all, the Iraqi army right now, the current Iraqi army, is actually stronger than it's ever been in the history of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much concluded. I mean, ISIS only controls about 4% of the country now. People will look at a map and say, oh, no, it controls the entire western part. Most of the western part is just desert. No one can control it. Iraq is only 4% of Iraq is habitable. Iraq is actually under the control of ISIS. And so the Iraqis have essentially, not obviously I shouldn't say the war is over yet, but they've essentially concluded a 3-year-long war with one of the most powerful militant groups in history, one of the most powerful paramilitary groups in history. And that's not an exaggeration. They were always able to improvise. They had their own primitive weapons production system. They knew how to utilize economic assets in order to recruit new fighters and to buy the sort of weapons that they couldn't build. So we're talking about one of the most efficiently well-led militias. The Iraqi army defeated them despite the U.S. claims that they helped them a lot with very little air support other than what the Iraqi Air Force could muster for itself. It's come out of this massive war. It's stronger than ever. We're talking the army alone is about a quarter of a million men. And then you've got the paramilitary popular mobilization forces, which themselves are like 250,000 that have American equipment. Both the Iraqi army and the popular mobilization forces have American equipment. They have Humvees. They have sort of M16 assault rifle or M4 assault rifles, whatever. They have Abrams tanks. They have, and then they also have a mix of Soviet equipment, but they know how to use it. And for America to invade Iraq again, it would need a bigger force than it took in to destroy Saddam's army. I'm not joking. It would need a bigger force. It would endure more casualties.
Well, it's just not politically feasible.
Yeah, and it's also simply not financially and politically feasible.
It's like we'd have a, you might as well reinvade Vietnam. That's about how popular that would be.
Exactly. I mean, if you can convince Congress to raise the debt budget, the debt ceiling by another $20 trillion for the next 2 years, then go ahead. But
even the Israeli lobby isn't that strong. This all came with the catalyst for that was the Kurdish referendum, and the timing with the UNESCO pullout and the decertification of the Iran deal, throwing Israel these bones, these sort of at face value bones. It may have been because the U.S. Cannot support the Kurdish referendum and cannot help them militarily, although the Israelis certainly do 100%, since 77% of their oil was coming from the Kurdish annexed territories in Iraq. 3/4 of Israeli oil has been
That's
going.
That's correct. 77%. 77% of Israeli oil imports, well, Israel's oil income, came from Barzani occupied Iraqi Kurdistan.
Hey, but you know what?
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Not at the same price.
Not anymore. That whole. I don't think we have seen. I guess we'll move on to it sort of now. The Kurdish referendum and the Iraqi response.
Well, let's
Iraqi
talk about the decertification, because I can sum it up in a minute.
Yeah, let's get to that.
You know, one, Trump was not alone on this act of stupidity, because if you watch the Republican primaries. Now I get to pick on the Republicans for a bit. We just bashed on the liberals. So Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, all the leading primary candidates were tripping over themselves as to how fast they'd tear up the Iran deal. And my first day in office, my first 100 days, well, day one, I'd tear up the Iran deal. Well, I'd do it in the first hour. You know, they're all like,
I'll do it the first minute.
Yeah, Graham, the rest of
get
them.
Get in and sign a deal straight away.
Yeah, I would have them pre-rip it before I get, no, whatever. You know, they all
rip it up while I'm getting inaugurated.
It's hard for them to criticize what Trump has done now, other than, oh, he didn't do it quick enough or whatever, because they all supported that. And people like Senator Cotton and stuff in the Congress, they really want to shred up this deal, because that is another way of placating to the Israelis. It doesn't serve U.S. interests. It doesn't serve the interests of our allies in Europe or Asia. It's ridiculous. And, you know, Barack Obama pulled a complete 180, because as a senator, he's the one that authored the bill to put sanctions on Iran. And he went around convincing our allies to put sanctions on Iran. But then a few things happened. You had Ukraine and Gazprom cutting off that source of oil, flows to Europe.
Then you have a very dry Europe.
Yeah.
So we have a very dry Europe all of a sudden, Western Europe, and they're twiddling their thumbs going, well, what's the next market we can go to, the next oil market?
And then you had the tsunami disaster in Japan, in Fukushima, which as a result had Japan turn off all of its nuclear power facilities. Now, Japan imports 99% of its fossil fuels. So if they're not getting electricity from nuclear power, that means it's got to come from somewhere else. And boy, it sure would be nice to have Iran's oil and gas again, which they bought, and they bought it with yen, too. Stop buying it in dollars.
Yeah.
They're willing to get around it. So a lot of pressure from Asia and Europe to do business with Iran, because it's good business.
And as you have mentioned, I believe, even before the Iran deal, this was going on. There was oil trade from Iran to Europe and Asia. And during the Iran deal, for whatever it was worth, of course, there was trade going on. And it will most likely continue. In fact, it 100% will continue, despite the fact that the deal has been decertified, whatever that means.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm going to explain what that is in a sec, but a little bit more on this trade. So there's a lot of pressure. So Obama, one good thing he ever did was he went along with this Iran deal, but dragging their feet, because even after like the deal was signed and Europe it was doing trade, you know, openly, not black market, but doing real trade business, airplanes from France and so on, they didn't unfreeze Iran's assets for a long time, because they kept saying, well, prove a negative. You know, prove you're not building nuclear weapons. And the inspectors went in, they poured concrete down into the buildings. Is that like there's no chance of them building a nuclear bomb? And they never were. They were trying to get nuclear power because the more electricity
they wanted to be able to produce
that,
electricity without, and then sell all that oil, and that's how you become a first world country.
Yeah, exactly. You get all that surplus oil that you used to consume on your own energy, you sell it on the open market, and that extra money can get you out of this debt gambit of borrowing money from, you know, World Bank, IMF, etc.
To have other countries refine your own oil.
Yeah. So there was a lot of reasons for Iran to do it, because people would say, why are they seeking nuclear power? They have plenty of oil. I'm like, well, because if they have nuclear power, all that plenty of oil goes in the market. It makes them very wealthy. It lets them build and pay for their own infrastructure debt-free, so they're not paying off interest constantly like a lot of African nations. Instead, they pay for it themselves all in one chunk without getting stuck in the debt and not paying the usury and so on. So that welcomed the first world, basically. So that was the reason for that. They needed the trade. People griped about America giving all this millions or billions of dollars to Iran, which they call a terrorist state. 2 points there. They didn't give them any money. They let them have their own money. It was assets that were frozen that they finally relinquished. And it's not a terrorist state. And Trump, I don't know if he's just an idiot or blowing a dog whistle, but he said Iran was supporting ISIS, and the opposite is true.
Or, there's no way he could have believed that.
He knows better. He said they're involved in 9/11.
Yeah, there's no way he could believe that either.
They sponsor terrorism. Now, Israel is guilty of all three of those things.
That's correct.
Israel,
and like you said, if you just take the word Iran out and put Israel in, it's 100% correct.
Yeah, exactly. You switch Iran and Israel, and that's what's true. And you know, Trump before, he talked about dancing Muslims on 9/11. I mean, the phrase dancing, right? There were dancing Middle Easterners. But they weren't from Iran, and they weren't Muslim.
Dancing Iranians.
I mean, and not only were the people he was referring to celebrating the 9/11 attacks, they belonged to a foreign country's intelligence service. Dominic Suter fled the country. They left furniture stranded. So I don't know.
He's thrown Israel some bones. What we can conclude is he's thrown Israel some bones, but it's all face value guff.
It's all fluff so far. The decertification does not even end the Iran deal. So he decertified it. That doesn't mean – all that says is like every 3 months or so, the U.S. would have to certify that Iran was complying, saying that they're not building the nuclear weapons and they're
– Just to put a couple other things into perspective, Turkey and Qatar – have always done trade with Iran. Qatar more than ever now because of the situation it finds itself in with Saudi Arabia and its partial isolation from the Gulf mainstream.
Well, they share a gas field, that Pars area.
Now, do you hear Qatar or Turkey ever comment about, the Iran deal? Do you ever hear them comment? No, because they know either way, whether it's certified or not, it doesn't change anything.
Yeah, I mean, even if the U.S.
If you want to do business with Iran, you can just do business with them.
Yeah, they can, and so can the U.S. The U.S. is still doing business with Iran. And if they were to walk away, they don't lose that much business anyway, because the bulk of it's in Europe and with their neighbors and for the energy side, to Asia, of course, India, South Korea, Japan, and China. They're even trying to build that pipeline. They've built one in the Pakistan, but they're trying to build it all the way down. It hits the ports there so it can go to China. They'd like to go all the way to China. It's very important.
That'd be a real regional game changer.
Ports, by the way. Right now,
that'd be a real regional game changer. That would actually affect most of the Eurasian continent.
Well, if it reaches to the Mediterranean and slide it through Israel to the Red Sea. You know, back when, right after the Egyptian Revolution, pre-Sisi, like when Morsi was there briefly, they reopened the Suez Canal to Iranian ships. So Iran was sending oil up through to Turkey and then through Egypt instead of Israel. So Israel lost its middleman status. And then suddenly Libya was invaded, and Egypt had another revolution, and now Sisi's in charge, and he's like Mubarak Part 2, and Al-Qaeda is running Libya, and the oil is now going back to Italy like it used to, and sliding through the Israeli pipeline, which ironically was jointly built by Israel and Iran pre-1979. Because Israel, before Kurdistan, this is in Jimmy Carter's book, if you want to look at it. This is the former president of the United States. Israel got 90% of its oil and gas from the Sinai Peninsula and Iran before the revolution in Iran.
Revolution.
And so this is why Oded Yanan and all these strategy plans have been targeting Iran ever since. Ever since 1979. That plan came out, 81, 82? I think it was 82.
82, three years after the revolution.
Mm-hmm. And they've been following that script, which the two of us are making a movie about, by the way. The movie's about Syria, but you got to understand Oded Yanan and a little bit of Iraq first.
And then you got to compare it to Iraq and then compare it to Syria, and it all falls into place.
It does. And I already did a film called War by Deception, which covers Iraq.
It's like, you don't even have to think. It's just obvious. It's just right there.
Oh, it's – I mean, it's even – this is easier than before too, because the larger the internet grows, the more obvious things come. I mean – we caught him on open mics talking about these kind of things. And so that's the Iran deal. Decertification is going to throw it into Congress, and the Republicans in Congress are going to fiddle with it and make new demands or not. Now, it will be up to them to pull out.
Politicians will do what they do, which is achieve nothing.
Yeah, pretty much. But they're also going to have to take the blame for it if they do something. The blame isn't all on Trump, it's on Congress, because they're the one. He gave them the opportunity, and it's up to them to put their money where their mouth is. Because a lot of them were voicing their pro-Israel support because they thought, that doesn't matter, I'm not going to have to really do anything decisive on this. Now they have to. Another good thing before I forget, we move on to the Iraq's attacking the Kurds, is I want to tell everyone about H.R. 81. Walter Jones and some others, I think Thomas Massey, the same clique who we lobbied and helped get the 28 pages declassified, or unredacted anyway, have issued a bill to end support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. And I'm actually going to go to D.C. again, just like before, in late February, early March, to meet with a congressman and also to do some lobbying in the respective committees that need to be lobbied. So if anybody wants to join me, after March 2nd is the TILAP conference. So March 3rd is the Sunday. So on Monday, if you want to meet and learn how to lobby, or just shadow, or you already know how to lobby and you want to come, please come join me, because this assault on Yemen has to end. And this is really going to force a debate in Congress.
Absolutely. It's a brutal invasion by Saudi regime forces their despicable allies, some of which are pure mercenaries.
They blamed it on
Iran. Have been recruited from Africa. They've literally gone to Africa and, you know, waved $5,000 American dollars in front of families that live in great poverty, and they've never seen that money in their lives, and they say, well, give us one of your sons so we can go squander his life in Yemen, and if he feels like it, he can loot and rape and kill as long as it's for our side.
That is exactly Ryan Grimm wrote an article about this. The UAE, which is kind of like what Britain is to the United States, the UAE is to Saudi Arabia. America and Saudi Arabia get all the hate, but they're little, like, secondary lapdogs that are usually involved in all the same conflicts, like Britain and United Arab Emirates, are very guilty. And the UAE, they lost 45 soldiers last month in September. It's a lot for them to get blood on their hands. And so now they're full on with the Sudanese mercenaries, and they've also brought in mercenaries from Colombia and, you know, South America. And Blackwater, which is now called R2.
You quickly remind me, how many times have they changed their name?
Four or five that I know of. I think five times. I remember four of the names. They had Blackwater. They had Academy. Between that, they were called Z, like X-E-Z. So yeah, Blackwater, yeah. Z, Academy, and then an R1. And there was another one between Academy and R1.
Yeah, D2.
Off the top of my head. But they have to keep rebranding. They're worse than Lockheed Martin. Lockheed doesn't change their name so much because
Lockheed doesn't change their name.
They don't care. They're like, what?
Yeah. So anyway,
Lockheed's such a piece of crap with the F-35, which was jointly built in Israel. This is something I also want people to understand. The MIC and the Israelis, you know, people argue or who's got whatever influence and stuff. No doubt the MIC has heavy influence.
Of course.
You got to understand, their most major
who enables them?
Projects?
Who enable...
Yeah, well, go ahead if you want to say.
Oh, no, you go.
Well, this I was is... just going to talk about the F-35 real fast because you're talking about $1.5 trillion. It's Lockheed Martin. It's obviously jointly built in Israel by the U.S. and Israelis together. So trying to separate these Jewish Zionists and the military-industrial complex, you can't really do it because they're so interwoven. You can't tell where one starts and one stops, especially with Lockheed Martin. That goes for the A-22 Raptor, the F-35, which is a Bradley fighting vehicle with wings.
That is correct. It's U.S. military is the Pentagon is reliving the 1980s, except this time it has wings.
What's that film with the about the Bradley?
Pentagon Wars.
The Pentagon Wars. Kelsey Grammer.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, that's it.
I think that we put that documentary up on A&C if you want to watch it in the next week or so. It'll be up there.
It's a movie, but it's like a documentary.
But it's true. I mean, it really happened.
Yeah.
It's with actors. Yeah. It's a movie. It's well done. You don't see a lot of films in Hollywood that go against the MIC. And this one squeaked through. Usually it's all praise, you know.
Very true.
They've got the A-22s in Avengers. I'm like, don't worry. The pilots will pass out. Dinah Razor.
And for the record, regarding the F-35, funnily enough, although Israel lobbied a lot to keep Lockheed Martin's Lemon alive, because they partly want to continue making profit by building parts of it by means of their own industry. Despite this, Israel has officially now received 7 F-35s, which they've all used in trials, testing. And even now, the Knesset just held a defense meeting on the next defense paper. I think they've even written the defense paper, if I'm not mistaken. And basically, they have big doubts about the F-35 after actually testing the piece of garbage themselves. They've got very big doubts.
Right. They want to build it because there's so much profiteering involved. But they don't want to use it because it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. I remember when I was a lot younger and I was really into the military reading, you know, articles and watching documentaries and socializing on threads with other military enthusiasts. I remember everyone talking about the F-35 going, oh, look at it. It looks so stealthy and it's so shiny and it's so, you know, high tech and the weapons bays and – my first comment was, the thing only has one bloody engine. The Russians, for example.
It's not stealth either.
And stealth doesn't exist. That's what I found out later, is stealth, there is no such thing as stealth. You can absorb the radar waves to some degree. You can reflect them to some degree. But you can only reflect them on a certain frequency. And what countries like Russia and China are doing, who are building very it's not even sophisticated air defense systems, but they're trying to keep up with the so-called stealth, is they're just modifying the frequency at which they can track. They're not lowering it so much that they can't track accurately. They're keeping it high enough so they can track accurately, but still low enough so that they can still illuminate the target and see it. So this stealth is just complete nonsense.
And the goop they put on it for that was knocking out not only the pilots, but even the ground crew were getting sick.
The fumes.
And some of the pilots were passing out because they pull the oxygen through this sleeve right out of the engine. I mean, instead of just using liquid air, like, I don't want to get triggered on it. It's a piece of crap. It doesn't even have a landing hook that matches any of the aircraft carriers. It's a Bradley. It's just like they combined budgets from several departments. They added a bunch of stuff because more people
They developed the concept over the course of, I mean, how long has it been developed for now? 12 years, 10 years or something?
Really.
They've been developing this concept. The Bradley went for 19 years, right? They've been developing this concept, this joint strike fighter concept. I mean, I would say beyond any flaws that the aircraft has that actually makes it unflyable, the fact it's got one engine in the 21st century is inefficient. A jet needs, especially one that costs that bloody much, at least... pardon the language, two fucking engines. It needs at least, I mean, I've never seen a three engine fighter jet, but I'm just saying
it needs two engines. The Bradley, I think it was like a third of all the Gulf War casualties were Bradley, those aluminum cans.
Yeah, and that's after they improved it.
Ugh.
That's after they were forced to improve it. They were forced to put in measures that would actually and yeah, even then it's like yeah.
That's the kind of profiteering you get, though, where it's not built for function. It's built based on how many contracts you can divvy out to certain congressional districts. You know, McNamara and Kennedy used to do this with the 111, the TXF or XF.
I can quote a few dud sentences that McNamara, pardon me, crapped out during his time. First thing he crapped out when it came to fighter jets was the idea, this is as they were developing, the F-111, which only ever turned out to be a bomber, not a fighter, because F designation sort of hints that it's meant to be a fighter. But anyway, first thing he said was that missiles were the future and that using cannons on jets were as something like as primitive as bows and arrows, and that the future was missiles. Well, it turns out that not every time you fired a missile, it stayed on target and hit it, especially back in those days. So a whole fleet, the entire American Air Force, the F-4s, everything, had to be reinstalled with cannon. They had to be completely overhauled and fitted with cannon because they realized that a cannon on an aircraft, even in the supersonic age, is critical. Of course, his nonsense idea of, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but maximum commonality, which was the idea that all the Air Force could procure this one plane, TX, whatever, this F1, what became the F111, and that it was going to do everything. And well, this was going to lead to...
No, his real reason was then you can combine the naval budget and the Air Force budget.
Yeah, that's correct.
Because they had this $6 billion surplus from Eisenhower, and all these government branches were just clawing all on top of each other to get at it. And
yeah, I know.
They went
what
out
did they
to
do?
The,
they squandered
they went out
it.
To the labor secretary, and they got a map up on the wall, and they looked at the zones that Nixon had gotten, and they're like, let's throw some jobs there, throw some jobs there. This has been going on. And this happens – this is what the Israelis have perfected, though. Because APAC – I think everyone knows, anyone that's listened to ANC report, they heard me say a zillion times – how APAC will come in, they lobby the Congress, they get these $1 billion in aid, more than that, tens of billions indirectly, and then they use a portion of that money back to bribe the Congress. So like, you spend a few million, you get a few billion. And that's what these giant state contractors do, because that's not free market when you're going to the government
no,
and
that's
no
not.
Big contract, right?
No, it's not at all.
That's what the donors that donate to APAC, a lot of these Jewish billionaires that are Israeli partisans from New Jersey, New York, places like that, they're just in the same sort of gambit of recycled money through the Port Authority, where they bribe the state politicians or blackmail them, like Charles Kushner did to Governor McGreevy, New Jersey, because the governor of New Jersey appoints the Port Authority's chairman, and then the governor of New York, they all have the most important appointments, but it's more slated to New Jersey because it's a smaller state, blah, blah, blah. All they're doing is they go there and they bribe them to get positions on the PA, and then as part of the Port Authority, they award themselves huge real estate contracts, and then they just take a portion of those profits and continue the bribery, and then it just goes in circles. And then the people who are enriched by that gambit then donate, become the big donors to APAC and the rest of it. You look up billionaires, see how many of them are real estate moguls. See how many of them got exclusive state contracts from Port Authority types.
Right.
There are no billionaires without the state, unless you invented
That's
something.
That's right.
Or something. It's almost unheard
of. But yet taxing people more will fix the problem, according to the liberal consensus.
Well, yeah, because, of course, you know, the benevolent government's going to redistribute that to the poor.
It's the corporations, man. It's the corporations.
The problem is not the corporations. We need corporations. That's how you and I are talking to each other. The problem is when it's business and state together, the cronyism. And that's what we need to attack. You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and be like, oh, capitalism sucks or free market sucks. No, the state sucks. And the state should not be picking winners and losers in the marketplace. I wrote a long book about it called The Separation of Business and State. You don't have to flop on one side of – or the other, you know, being a full-blown commie or a socialist, that not everything's a business, not everything's a commodity and service. You know, it's one thing for the government to deliver the mail or have public school or something. It's another thing for them to be favoring real estate moguls or giving trillion-dollar contracts to weapons industries to build useless toys.
That's the antithesis of capitalism.
It is. It's state.
Because there's no competition.
Right. There's no market competition, and the money is not generated from production. It's generated from awards by the government. State contracting. Yep. State contracting is socialism. And it's the government redistributing wealth to who it feels like, you know, for the sake of their own business. So it's cronyism, and state contracts are usually filled with nepotism. You know, if you're going to build a road, the normal way is we do have capitalism. It works. When you don't have nepotism, you have an auction. A bunch of companies compete for the contract, and the one who can do it the best for the least amount of money is chosen. And yeah, they are paid by tax money, but the government is acting more as an organizing facilitator there and allowing them to compete for the contract. What happens in cronyism is there is no competition for the contract because the government
it goes to the same people who've got the same privilege. Yeah, I know.
And they get caught and they go to jail. Kushner went to jail for blackmailing. Kushner went to jail, but they get out of jail. And the thing is, just like with Lockheed Martin, and I believe you told me in the past that there's a Wikipedia page.
There's an entire Wikipedia page for Lockheed Martin scandals going back to like the 1950s or something.
It's just like DuPont, you know, and their pollution and things. All the trouble they get in never costs them as much as what they make by breaking the law. So they keep breaking the law.
That's right.
But at least there is some punishment, some of them going to jail, etc. The solution was saying, oh, I don't like cronyism, so I'm going to give the government even more power, let them confiscate all private property and disuse all business.
Now you're moving out of the SJW area into full-blown commie.
Yeah, I mean, communism fails. I can't think of a more selfish philosophy either. Like, please.
It's amazing how it disguises itself.
They just want to be in college forever. Have people take care of them.
The redistribution of wealth. Give it all to the government.
Yeah, wealth is not distributed. It's a product. It comes from production. You know,
that's right.
Okay, anyway.
So anyway.
Moving along.
Anyway.
Current events. I'm going to turn the mic over to you because Unesco and Iran deal, the Israeli stuff's kind of my thing. What happened in Iraq? I know what happened, but I want to hear it because it just makes me smile. And these people deserve it so much. What was Kurdistan, you know, in Iraq? Like, explain that geography.
And then what
happened in the last 46 hours or so?
Oh, yeah, well, in the last 2 days, essentially now, it's been about 2 days now. Basically, what we've seen with the Kurdish referendum, which, by the way, half of Iraqi Kurds didn't support and didn't even want to vote or couldn't vote because the Barzani regime knew what they were going to vote. They were going to say no, so it didn't let them. There's a lot of evidence to say that even the 92% thing, but anyway, regardless of any scandals or anything,
about as real as global
the referendum scientists. was trying to legitimize a secession of for the Barzani regime to create a sort of an ethnic state like Israel out of Iraq, to simply stilt historical Iraqi territory and say that this is now Kurdistan. That's what you call secession, and that generally leads to the government of the country that's being threatened losing a piece of its territory to respond. And the Iraqi government did respond. I personally didn't think the response would come so soon. I thought they would take a few more different approaches. And for a time, it even seemed like the Iraqi government was about to cuck for Kurdistan. But no,
well, what was instead, Kurdistan? They must... though, just the northern Iraq territory was run by Kurds.
Yeah, it's northwest in Iraq. It's the northeast of the country. It's got a high Kurdish population, but they're not only Kurds there. There are other peoples. Iraq, like most Levantine countries, it's you got Arabs, Turkmen, Kurds, of course. You've got other Iranian peoples who aren't Kurdish, and so on. Like most Levantine countries, it's got a very, well, in fact, like most Middle Eastern countries, full stop. It's got a very ethnically and confessionally diverse sectarianally diverse demographic. And the one thing the Iraqi government has always stressed is unity. Unity amongst sects and unity amongst ethnics, amongst ethnic demographics. One Iraq. And basically the Barzani regime, Barzani isn't even Iraqi, he's an Iranian. He's an Iranian Kurd, an Iranian Kurd. He basically wanted to say, no, we're going to create our own, well, we didn't say Israel, but they were waving Israeli flags, for example, in solidarity, and Israel was waving so-called Kurdistan flags in solidarity.
You know, I'm not a fan of Erdogan or whatever, but I do like his quote about that.
Oh, yeah, Israeli flags won't save you, and I don't like him either, but boy, was he right. Israeli flags clearly didn't save the Kurdish project, the final phase of the Kurdish project, which was to create a separate state, to carve one out of Iraq. Anyway, the government, which I thought, it seemed they were about to cuck, because they were in negotiations. I thought, oh, here we go. We're about to see them accept the fact that Kurds want to break. Well, no, the Iraqi government took about a week out to muster about 100,000 troops and 5 armored divisions.
It's important to note that they saw the Americans are not backing the Kurds. It's just the Israelis.
That's right. Americans, it became apparent from day one. The Americans denounced the referendum and said you shouldn't have done it.
The giant was gone, and it was just the loudmouths alone.
Yeah, that's right. And really, the Kurds have become very hubristic. The separatist Kurds, that school of thought has become very hubristic, and now it's backfired terribly.
Trash they talked after Mosul.
Oh, no, talking about how the mighty Peshmerga was going to defend the city of Kirkuk to the last man and woman, and they lost the city in 24 hours, well, 16 hours, actually. So, basically, Kirkuk, I would say safely, was liberated, wasn't captured, wasn't seized. It didn't fall.
Yeah, they didn't burn it down or anything.
Yeah, it wasn't sacked. It was liberated. It was liberated from...
It was like Aleppo.
A hostile... Yeah, it was liberated from a hostile pseudo-polity that tried to establish a racist ethnic state in the country. Carving racist ethnic state out of Iraq. And, of course, you'd only ever find Israel backing a project like that. for sake of like-mindedness, you know, oh, we understand what they're all about.
And,
we've been doing it for
oil.
60 years, 70 years. So,
do you remember all the press on Aleppo, the last fill in the blank of Aleppo?
Oh, well, this is people would say that the victory against IS in Mosul was the Aleppo victory for Iraq. I disagree. I believe it was this latest operation, very successful operation against the separatist Barzani regime and the forces loyal to it, the Peshmerga. Basically, I would say this is the Aleppo victory for Iraq, where they've prevented one of the most dangerous threats to their sovereignty, which was planned, as we know, as early as the 80s in the Annan plan, that this idea that there would be a Kurdistan carved out of Iraq, and that it would embrace an area as far south as Kirkuk, because of they understood that that's where a lot of the Iraqi oil was. And as we know, even before the Barzani regime attempted official separation, they were selling that oil. 77% of Israel's oil came from Iraqi Kurdistan. That were selling it at total lapdog prices.
Oh, but it was
prices.
The U.S. war for oil.
Oh, as they say, yeah, it was America's war. It was America. I mean, America, yeah, okay, America sent 250,000 troops there to overthrow the Saddam government and maintained an occupation with another 150,000 troops for the next 8 years
or
so.
But you and I know all that money and troop, all that blood and cash that was spent.
That's for Israel.
Well, yes, for Israel interests. All the pre-war lies that led to the war in Iraq, none of them came from oil and gas companies. They already had the oil for food program. All of that came from Jewish neocons in the Pentagon and the office of the vice president, mostly. All of it. They lied. The anthrax from Iraq was the origin of that story was Israeli security forces. The yellow cake from Niger was Michael Ladine of Gorbanifarz's partner of Iran-Contra fame, which is also a bunch of little neocons, which involved the Israelis. Again, it's called Iran-Contra, but who were we partnered with in Iran-Contra? It was Israel selling the illegal weapon parts to Iran. So, anyway, all of the pre-war lies came from Jewish neocons who were Israeli partisans. Some of them even had family members who were settlers. Yeah,
of course.
Like Paul Wolfowitz, who was also involved in Iran-Contra, and Douglas Feith, who had the OSP. So it's just hard for people to acknowledge it. It was not a war for oil or petrodollars. They went to war for Israel. And the reason they put sanctions on Iran, because that's in Israeli interest. And the reason there's a big proxy war in Syria is because that's what Israel wants. And they've exclusively sided with Al-Qaeda. Recently, you know, they go into Lebanon and then fire from there into Syria. They recently got tagged. So there was this Israeli war. And it's really clear that this is Israel's war, but it's falling apart.
Yes, that's correct. Obviously, I mean, it's falling apart in Syria. Still a lot of work to be done, but it's falling apart, and it just completely collapsed in Iraq in the last 2 days. 30 years of planning just went down the shitter.
How much territory did they gain there? Like, what? Okay,
well, it's ongoing. The operation is ongoing. We're seeing, you know, again, across the entire Kurdish-held frontier in Iraq, the Iraqi army mustered like 100,000 men in 5 armored divisions. And then you got PMU fighters, which I think is probably at this point another 100,000 in various brigades, which all have the same equipment as the Iraqi army. They all have modern weapons. They've just come fresh out of defeating the most powerful paramilitary group in history. Basically, the Peshmerga hadn't fought a real battle in at least a year. They haven't shared a front line with ISIS since Mosul, and even then they didn't really engage ISIS around Mosul. They captured some areas north of the city, but ISIS just surrendered that area and turned their forces to the Iraqis, who actually had to fight the battle for the city and the approach to it from the south. The Iraqi army, and I have to say, this is probably one of the biggest military operations in terms of scale and the scale of it and the scope of the objective since, ironically, the invasion of Iraq in 2003. This is probably the biggest military set-piece military operation. The Iraqis organized it in less than a week. That's how desperate they were to simply destroy this separatist, this hostile separatist entity. Barzani regime forces, aka the Peshmerga, are in a state of complete rout. They have been since the operation began. Kirkuk was liberated within 16 hours. The oil fields, all the oil fields around Kirkuk, Barzani's economy was completely seized from him within 24 hours. And today, the oil fields are now back in action and operating. No damage was done. They're back in operation and they're under Iraqi people control, as I like to say. That's back in the hands of the Iraqi people. Along this the northeast Syrian border and the equivalent, the northwest Iraqi border, the Iraqi forces have secured that area, the border crossings. They basically punched a hole through Sinjar, which is a major city that's the gateway to that border region. They've reconnected with the Iranian border, and I believe that they are going to roll all the way onto Erbil. I can't confirm it, but they will roll all the way onto the Kurdish capital in Iraq, which is Erbil.
It seems like they're going to be able to hit that from the south and the west.
Oh, they will hit it from the north, west, and south. They are going to roll up all the countryside around it. We're talking, again, 100,000 men, 5 divisions, all fully equipped, all battle-hardened. Morale is higher than it's ever been. and they're fighting scumbags that know they're in the wrong. Who do you think's going to win? I mean, there's no US air support backing up the scumbags. The most the US has ever been able to say about the situation so far is, and I more or less quote, it's not a direct quote, but more or less a quote, we don't take any side on the current confrontation, but we support the unity of Iraq. Basically, they just flipped off the Kurds without saying it.
Cannon fodder, so, stabbed in the back again.
Well, we're not the there's Kurds, a reason why.
Yesterday, maybe a day and a half ago, trying to put out like false reports and rumors that US Air Force was on the way. They were,
you know, part of my job is to track social media, and I would see all these sources saying coalition aircraft now flying over Kirkuk, ready to bomb Baghdad forces in support of Kurdish freedom fighters. And I thought, I wonder what this source is. I'd click on it. Oh, it's a Kurdish source. You know, it's Rudwell News or it's Kurdistan 24 News or some Kurdish activist that has 100,000 Twitter followers who are idiots, obviously. It's the only reason why you would follow a Kurdish activist. It was all nonsense reports. And just to another update, not breaking or anything, but something that I noticed in the last few hours, the French president has contacted the Iraqi government, al-Abadi, has contacted him and said, we congratulate you on securing the unity of Iraq.
Man.
France just said that. So, and Germany yesterday officially cut off all arms deals with the Peshmerga. They've ended the sale. There was no debate. They just ended the sale of weapons to Peshmerga regime forces. So, basically, Europe has, just like America, clarified its stance indirectly.
Israel must be having a fit.
Oh, I cannot imagine if there is anyone that is more upset than the Barzani loyalists, it would have to be Israel. 30 years of planning just went to shit in 2 days. And it will continue to go to shit as Iraqi forces merge on Erbil.
And now it seems obvious that the Kurdish forces in Syria have less to negotiate with now.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, there's about to be a major battle in Syria for control of the Al Omar oil fields, which have, for the last 3 years, been under the control of the Islamic State savages. So-called Islamic State. It's been under their control, and basically the YPG, which disguises itself as the Kurdish YPG, which disguises itself as the Syrian Democratic Forces, because that sounds more universal and nice. Basically, they're making a push to capture the oil field, and the Syrian government-led forces, the Syrian army and the paramilitary National Defense Forces, these groups are merging to try and capture it. It appears that the government forces will take the Al Omari oil fields first. These oil fields produced 25% of Syria's pre-war oil production. It's a very large field. It's a number of wellheads under a single name. Again, Al Omar. And basically, it's so close to the Iraqi border anyway that even if the YPG took it, by the time they repair the facilities, the PMU will be ready to just waltz into Syria and take it on behalf of the government, because the PMU, the Iraqi government, and the Syrian government are close. They're close. They're part of the Baghdad, Moscow, Damascus, quite frankly, Beirut, Tehran alliance format. They're part of that format.
Would you say the combination of the Kurds and like Sunni extremists like Wahhabi, these Salafist groups, have actually helped to unify Shia and Sunni together against this common enemy and Turks as well?
Yeah, of course, by their barbaric actions separately, but in the same way. One of them claims to be, you know, one of them claims to be the Sunni master race and the other one claims to be the Kurdish master race. It's the same essential ideology, just insert different supreme being name here. Basically, but especially the Kurds, if anything, have helped to unify not just Sunni and Shia and Christian, but they've helped to unify Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran. I mean, what's the point? America understands this. What's the point of having a Kurdistan puppet regime if you're going to be surrounded by, if you're going to lose Turkey to Russia and you're going to lose the Iraqi government to Iran? Well, what's the point? There's no point. So that's why America pulled out, pragmatic reasons. The Kurdish project didn't work out. And when, like with all things with the American foreign policy, when it doesn't work out, you just pack your shit and leave.
So Hillary wouldn't have. She would have supported put a no-fly zone in. And
A no-fly zone that Turkey doesn't care about. Turkey's been bombing the PKK in northern Iraq whilst all this has been going on. And the media, everything's been zip about it. They've said nothing. Mm-hmm. Turkey's playing its role in sort of suppressing the transportation of troops towards to meet Iraqi forces. They're carrying out sort of a strategic interdiction role at the moment. They're limited capacity, but they're doing something.
I want to interject quick point. It is sad what happened to the Kurds in the 90s. There was mass ethnic cleansing of Kurdish people in Turkey. But that does give them the right to then turn around and do it to someone else.
Well, you would argue that where's the justice when they're using that excuse to do sinister things themselves?
Right. It's like screaming Holocaust, therefore I can kill
Palestinians. That's right, and then committing one yourself, as we see in Israel.
Palestinians had nothing to do with World War
II. Yeah, well, what did exactly. So but I would like to clarify something. This is actually not a Kurdish-Iraqi war. This is a Barzani regime loyalist versus Iraq war. This is a Israeli proxy versus Iraq. First of all, there are two major Kurdish political entities. One of them's a group, and one of them's an ethnic group, and one of them's a political entity, which are on side with the Iraqi government, which support the current military operation, which are against the Barzani fascist separatist regime. Sorry, I can't think of enough words to throw at this guy. he's really that much of a crook. You've got the PUK, which is the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. They are pro-Iraqi government. They are pro-unity. Even before the military operation started, they said, it's led by a guy called Talabani, they have said that Barzani needs to step down and that Iraq must be unified and that this referendum agenda is nonsense. And do you know when the Iraqi forces took Sinjar yesterday, the city of Sinjar is famous for a massacre, where a genocide that ISIS committed, whereby the Yazidi peoples were isolated and surrounded, and women, it's really disgusting, women went missing for reasons we know what happened to them. Children were kidnapped, men were shot, it was disgusting, it was an outright genocide. The Yazidis are not angry with the Iraqi government that happened to that. They're angry with the Peshmerga. And the very first people to welcome the Iraqi army back into Sinjar when it was liberated from Barzani regime forces were the Yazidis, who are Kurdish peoples themselves. They just follow a different religion. Most Kurds are Sunnis. They follow a different, they stick with an old Iranic religion that's still a fire-worshipping religion. This is why ISIS was so brutal to them, because they considered them pagans.
ISIS doesn't even like Nike shoes because the swoosh might be Hermes.
Yeah, I know. if you don't like Nike, I mean, exactly, what do you like? You must hate your own mother. But some of the PMU, everyone says, oh, the PMU is a Shiite militia. It's not. It's made up, about 55 to 60% of it, and this is proportionate to the Iraqi population for the record, is Shiite. Another 30% is Sunni, made up of tribes which were originally thought were going to swear loyalty to ISIS, but they didn't. They stuck with the Iraqi government. And the other 10% is made up of Christians and Yazidi minorities. The Yazidis were the ones to actually chase the Peshmerga out of Sinjar before the Iraqi army arrived. They're the ones that opened the gates for them. So what I'm trying to say here is that both politically and militarily, there are large sections of the Iraqi Kurdish population which support this current military action designed to prevent a secession, an illegal secession of Iraqi territory to a hostile, racist, ethnic state. So, backed by Israel.
Barzani's more crooked than Owen Wilson's nose.
He is. He is very, very crooked, and he's done business with them all.
He's a dead man.
He's not that I have anything against Saddam necessarily, but just a piece of embarrassing history for him and his current. I mean, he made an alliance with Saddam back in the day. He made an alliance with Saddam, you know, back when everyone was meant to assume that Saddam was a bad person. He was an evil dictator. All this stuff they said about him. Well, Barzani was a friend of that supposed evil dictator in order to get one over on other Kurdish rival polities.
You know who else was Saddam's friend? The CIA back in the 60s.
Oh, yeah. Donald Rumsfeld, they were all great friends with that evil dictator. Weapons of mass destruction wielding dictator once upon a time.
McFarlane's in there too, that kind of infamous handshake. He's in the background, I think. There's a number of them. Though it's just pesticides, not mustard gas.
Yes.
But,
so
you know,
anyway.
The U.S. sold weapons to both sides in the Iran-Iraq War. I mean, that was the point of Oded Yunnan was to get Arabs and Persians to kill each other. And they flat out say every Arab-on-Arab conflict benefits the strength of Israel.
That's right.
I can't wait film out. Syria, Israel's Invisible Hand, that's sort of our working title right now. It really nails it down clearly, gets rid of all the distractions and what I call sensationalist alt media, gets rid of all that, and just gets down to the brass tacks. And
Israel was behind
it. Yeah, it is. It's not the Illuminati. It's none of these nefarious, you know, groups. It's
interdimensional reptilians,
psychic vampires, or whatever the hell Jonestown was saying. Pranic energy. They're building a gate to open a dimension to hell. And Keck is becoming gay because he's a frog. Keck is from Korea. It's kind of like, you know how we write like ha 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 or something, or I guess people now write LOL, but they're sort of way of like
moving
laughing is doing the like that.
I'm sure if liberals had caught on to the kek thing, that it wouldn't be associated with racism and Nazism, which has got nothing to do with that.
No, it's
just to celebrate, just to be jubilant in a celebratory moment. Kek.
There was the great meme war of 2016. Well, I mean, it got to the point because you get shut out of any conversation if you didn't toe the line of identity politics, that people started out evangelizing the evangelists. It's one of my favorite tactics. It's like you just copy their behavior but do it worse, because that's the way of seeing it. You know, it's like with I think it was George Carlin or Gallagher, somebody said, you know, when you're driving a car, anyone going slower than you is an idiot. Anyone going faster than you is a maniac. You know, so you just pass the person that passed you. They realize how out of control it is. But Bill Hicks had the best one. He there was some anti-abortion group, and whatever your belief is on that, whatever. But they were going around posting pictures of, like, you know, fetuses and with messages and stuff. Real gotcha type. Like, look at this bloody thing. And so he got on their website and he's like, so what you're saying is these aren't fetuses, they're babies, they're children, right? And under your worldview, they're children, right? And they go, yeah, these are children. And he goes, are these children wearing any clothes? Like, well, no, they're in the womb. He's like, so you're posting naked pictures of babies? You pedophile. He doesn't like, how dare you post naked children all over the neighborhood? And like, we out evangeled the evangels. Now you can always out SJW the SJW, and you can see them in a conversation with themselves between each other. They can barely talk. Like, everything is so offensive to them. Their whole conversation is like, I don't really like this guy that much, but Steven Crowler like infiltrated him. They could not have a conversation with each other without constantly apologizing and go, oh yeah, that might be insensitive to so and so. Like, they don't know what pronoun to use. They can't talk about anything, and everything is about race, sex, and creed and stuff. It's I'd say borderline mental illness. These people, they're useless.
Well, very stupid to say the least.
Yeah, it's something else. It's a phenomenon, I guess. Like, maybe a lot of these idiots have always been around, but it's just social media that gives them a microphone. But I think a lot of it, the culture's just changed. So I've never personally met anyone that dumb in my life. And I'm like, where
could you even call it culture? That's the question.
I mean, cultural Marxism is a term that's thrown around, which is an odd name because it really has nothing to do with Marxism, but it's, you know, that sort of, Thomas DeLorenzo calls them watermelons, the green on the outside, red on the in. But the goal was never about like utopia or anything. That was just a theme. The goal was control. That's why they're supporting.
That's correct. Yeah. Oh God, we're bloody going off topic now.
Well, that,
that's,
you know what?
Do
we'll just save that for another time.
Yeah, let's.
What else is this Iraqi takeover of Iraq? How is that going to affect
Iraq falling to itself, according to the Kurdish perspective, the Barzani regime perspective? Iraq is occupying itself. It's launching an invasion of itself.
Well, it's going to be good for oil futures if you bought that, or digital coins, because all that stuff's going to shoot up from this. I'm wondering how it's going to most affect Syria, because in Syria, and correct me if I'm wrong, ISIS is pretty much done.
That's correct.
They had that moment where they left one retreat route right into al-Nusra, which they took, and the infighting began, and the rats started killing each other. Really, the only force worth, you know, the only faction left in Syria that can really stand against the government is the Kurdish faction.
That's right, and that's only with American air support, which I don't think the Americans are going to commit to. If the government forces attack them tomorrow, then America would probably bomb the government forces, not in an all-out bombing campaign, but just to blunt the spearhead forces leading the attack. So obviously the government can't launch the attack tomorrow, but basically, that's only because America wants to wait until ISIS is gone, so then it can just say, oh, look, we defeated ISIS.
Mm-hmm. They want to have a victory America's and get out, because they're waiting to get out of there.
Yeah, they're busting to get out. They want to send all those frontline forces they have to bolster their Pacific front. They're scaling down in the Middle East. Ironic that Trump is the one that's doing it. He's meant to be a warmongering Republican, when really he's actually scaling down the U.S. troop presence. How funny it is, quickly, that Obama says he's going to scale down the U.S. troop presence, yet increases it, and yet Trump talks like he's going to increase it, but he's actually decreasing it.
Yeah, exactly.
How funny. You know, how funny.
And something you said reminded me, I forgot to mention about the Iran deal. Very important thing, too. I guess I've said it so many times, I forgot whether I'd said it or not, but that nuclear deal, you know, you set it up over a course of years with one president, the next comes in and decertifies it. If the Congress does pull out, which would be so stupid, how in the world can you negotiate a nuclear deal with North Korea when they're looking at what you do with Iran?
They're going to take you seriously.
They got a double prong. When a country doesn't have weapons of mass destruction, like Libya or Iraq, you invade them and kill their president and you know, hang one, sodomize the other with a knife. And when they peacefully agree and allow inspectors in and say, look, we're not building anything, you just find an excuse to cancel the deal anyway. So they're not going to be able to negotiate with North Korea. And unfortunately, I think there's no real military solution there either. So it's going to be more of the same, heavy sanctions, heavy starvation. It's terrible for the people of North Korea.
Of course. You know, if the political forces in America were ever genuine on bringing a better life to North Koreans, the first thing they would do is drop all the sanctions and say, yeah, look, we'll trade with you.
Yeah, you don't have to trade weapons or anything. Just trade agriculture.
No, just anything. Trade anything. Trade corn. Trade corn and wheat.
I think they are sending them some food in a limited way, but at an overpriced sort of situation.
Yeah.
But well, they need machine parts so that they can farm themselves. You know, that they need these things. And
give it 10 years and the North Koreans will overthrow the government for the Americans happily. They'll go, oh, well, this capitalism really works. Well, I want more of it.
Yeah,
well how do we do that?
Peace. I mean, that's why you look at South Korea and Japan, for example. Japan brutally occupied and annexed South Korea for 40 years and then lost World War II to the Americans and then – that was all of Korea, really. Then South Korea has their civil war with North Korea. But there's no way South Korea and Japan would go to war today because there's just too much business to lose.
There's too much.
Same reason
why China and Japan won't go to war.
There's too much trade.
Too much trade. You know, the Japanese, they're so-called pro-confrontation politicians in Japan who, like Trump, talk a bunch of hot air.
Like Tato.
And China, and then China says some things back in response, but they're not going to go to war.
No, and you know what? Those kind of guys, factions, the Tato factions in Japan and in China, they get all the media attention, but they're seriously a super small minority. It's just that's what gets on TV. That's what sort of sells.
That's what sells.
But they are not at all. Like when the Tokyo extremists tried, for example, to change the textbooks, history textbooks, you know, denying comfort women and so on like that. All 47 prefectures rejected it. The Board of Education, you know, on the local level said, no, we're keeping the books how they are. We're not going to change them. But it got all this attention and it got the reaction from the Chinese and the Koreans that was expected, you know, and it focused on that and island disputes and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, nothing changed. All the territory is the same. All the books are the same. It was a lot of hot air politics.
Yeah.
But nobody is better at trolling and ballooning than Donald Trump.
Oh, he's a new age champion when it comes to that.
I mean, he's a Twitter master.
He is a Twitter master, isn't he?
Can you imagine
he's sitting up at 2 in the morning with his glass of wine and he's
– No, he doesn't drink.
Okay, fair enough. I'm just trying to put it in a context.
In a drunk driving accident.
I'm just trying to put it in a context of you know, like what you would imagine, like, you know, just sort of, what can I say to piss North Korea off? Oh, okay. Blah, 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 blah. Of course, it doesn't mean anything.
No, but it worked in a way, and I'm not saying he's playing 4D underwater chess or anything, but, you know, North Korea had a chance at the UN to voice genuine grievances they had about Foul Eagle, the jointly conducted war games that the U.S. and South Korea do, practicing an invasion of North Korea every year, sometimes biannually. There's a long list of things he could have brought up, real things that the U.S. and South Korea are doing that are provocations. But instead of talking about any of that, all he did was react to the Little Rocket Man speech and blew it.
Rocket
the foreign minister of North Korea completely blew it. Now, either Trump's a genius or just he's not. It's just Trump was being, you know, his kind of adolescent, immature.
He seems to stir things up and then just take what looks like while it's all in the air, he just snatches what looks best.
He triggered them and, you know, they reacted the wrong way because they were threatening to hit California with missiles. And that just turned the whole world against them. Any sympathy they could have generated, you know, from the trade restrictions and the War Games Acts, which are legitimate, and the U.S. Maneuvering troops from Guam and all they didn't talk about any of that. He's just like, you're going to see our missiles soon. You think, because he has to act like that because that's the nature of a communist dictatorship. Because when he goes home, if he doesn't do the tough guy routine, he might end up in a labor camp or something. You know? So,
yeah.
He got him. He got under his skin. And I don't think that was like planned out by Trump. It certainly wasn't his administration, because they were caught like, wow, he can't believe he did that. I don't know why you'd be shocked by anything he does at this point, but it did work. So
he's Trump.
That's all I could keep saying. I criticize the hell out of the stuff he does, but at the end of the day, the results are he got what he wanted. So he's a billionaire for a reason, I suppose. I don't know. It might be the alien that lives on his head.
Oh, yeah. Called hair. You know, if you subscribe to Ike, you might believe that. So.
Yeah, there you go. I thought I'd call him Demon Icky. These people.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to talk too much Asian politics. I think we covered the ground we set out to do. So let's wrap it up here, and I'll have you back on shortly, hopefully to promote the film. You got a timeline. You're doing some of the visuals there, I think, is what's left. You got a timeline for me?
About a week.
Really? All right.
About a week. That's accounting for distractions, which seem to come up every second day or so.
I know how that is, so...
Yeah, so, but the audio is covered.
Good.
The audio is covered, and
narration's
basically
done.
I just got to do the visuals, and then I got to time the visuals with the audio, and then throw it all onto Movie Maker.
It's all the Mindux Sai stuff, we say. The tedious, busy work that goes into movie making.
Yeah, well, you know, back when I was making map videos about the Syrian war and everything, updating the war.
2 minutes is 2 hours.
Oh, 2 minutes is 16 hours. No, it's about 6 hours per minute of when you're doing something like with maps and things. About 6 hours, comes to about 6 hours per minute of film. So... yeah, it ain't easy.
That's what people don't understand about my Kennedy film. The research alone took more than a decade. So how long do you think the film part's going to be?
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I hope the Patreon kicks it up, because I've been getting some nuggets recently and ready to get that out there. But Syria first, Yemen next, because these are pressing current issues where real people are dying right now. And Kennedy can wait. So
what's happening in Yemen is what has been happening since April 2015 is... really, it's disgusting what Saudi Arabia is doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically Obama was giving Saleh all these weapons to fight the AQAP, and instead he attacked the Houthi with them instead and lost. And every time he attacked them, they got stronger. Then they put the Vice President Hadi in an election where he was the only name on the ballot. Hillary Clinton praised it as, you know, the supreme democracy. And now, you know, the Saudis are involved, the UAE is involved, and all their mercenaries. And basically, the poorest country in the Middle East is being attacked by the wealthiest countries in the Middle East, just getting slaughtered. And the world's turning a blind eye. But we do have a bill in Congress. Like I said, because of the way they finessed around the War Powers Act, the Senate cannot filibuster this bill. They cannot let it die in committee, where it just sits in committee and they never talk about it. It's just in there and they never get time on the floor. It's going to get forced to go to the floor. We can end the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and the war in Yemen. I'm telling you, just like I told you about the 28 pages, you thought that was a lost cause. Been going on for 10 years. I started getting involved, went and lobbied, and it got declassified. And I'm confident if you support me again, we'll get this bill done, and we can help save a lot of lives in Yemen. I'm serious about it.
Yeah.
I'm not – people are like, what are we going to do? Like, well, here's some concrete thing you can do right now. You want to end the war in Yemen? Because if America stops supporting Saudi Arabia, it's pretty much done. And this is going to happen. I promise you that. It's H.R. 81 if people are interested. The Congressman Walter Jones from North Carolina is a good person to contact about it. Tell him you want to support any way you can. And his staff will reach out to you and let you know what you need to do. You know, essentially,
very well.
There's no gain in bombing Yemen. It's just, you know, Saudi Arabia has a much bigger lobby than Yemen does, so they win.
Yeah,
I don't think Yemen has a lobby at all. I mean, there's nobody.
Poor little Yemen doesn't. Mind you. Those Houthis, lobby or no lobby, latest weapons or no latest weapons, they know how to fight.
Oh, yeah.
Despite the shittiness of their greater strategic situation. They certainly know how to decimate Saudi-led forces.
They know how to fight, and these perfume princes don't know how to fight. So despite all the superior everything, they are losing significant amounts of money and equipment to very little on the other side.
That is right.
All right, well, we'll talk Yemen another time. Thanks for everything and the analysis on the Kurdish situation. I know that's an ongoing conflict, and there'll be updates in the next day and the day after for sure. I want to know what's going to happen to that oil, where it's going to go, who's going to buy it, and I want to know if they do get to Erbil or not. So I'll have you on in the near future.
Okay.
Thanks.
Are you ready? Hey, think you could tell us what to do? You think you could tell us what to wear? You think that you're better? Well, you better get ready. Bow to the masters. Break it down! You can tell me what to do. You know who you're talking to. But you better get used to the way the war bounces. I see what you got, it measures in ounces. But that's a break, boy. You're a big man. I'll treat you like you're a little man. Tell me what to do.